Thank you. I'm told it's tradition to hold the mic, but I'm having a little trouble with that today. So you'll excuse my two broken wrists and excuse me from my mouth still works. So I said, okay, but I can't hold the microphone. If you can hear, anyone who can, if you can't hear me at all during the speech at some point, just raise both of your hands and I'll know that I need to get closer. Okay? My lecture on Jewish environmental ethics is three words long. V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. As someone much more famous than me once said, the rest is commentary. The corollary to V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha is lo ta'amod al dam reacha, you shouldn't stand on the blood of your neighbor. If you are to love your neighbor and to fulfill that commandment properly, you must also fulfill the commandment of making sure to protect your neighbor and guard your neighbor from harm. So let's explore what it means, what the halakha says we have to do and what lengths we have to go to protect our neighbor from harm. If you look at the second source, the Shulchan Aruch, the Shulchan Aruch says, Haro'eh et chaveiro toveya bayam, o listim ba'in alav, o chaya ra'ah ba'a elav, V'yachola hatzilo, hu ba'atzmo, o she'ishor acharim lahatzil, v'lo hatzil. And if you look at the very end, it gives a whole bunch of examples. And at the very end it says, over alo ta'amod al dam reyecha. So the Shulchan Aruch, and we'll see a number of other sources say, if you see somebody in a dangerous situation, and it gives some examples, the first one we read is someone who's drowning in the river, and you're able to save him, then you have to save him, or you violate the halacha of lo ta'amod al dam reyacha. But not just are you required to jump in and save him. If you can't swim, you can't say, well, what can I do? You're actually halachically obliged to find someone. If there's someone there you could pay with your own money to save that person, it is your halachic obligation to pay somebody out of your own pocket to save that person. And according to the halacha, if you don't spend your own money to save the life of someone else, you have violated the commandment, lo ta'amod al dam reyacha. And so we see, and this is not just in Shulchan Aruch, and I brought a number of sources, this is in, I brought the Rambam, this is in the Gemara, it's all over. You are halakhically obliged to spend your own money, put yourself out personally, to save somebody else. So you are required to use your own property, not just your own abilities, but your own property to make sure that you are not, it's ta'amod al dam reyacha, you are not allowing your neighbor, your friend, your fellow Jewish person to come to harm. Okay? So that's, let's just start with that as a precept, and that's really the corollary to v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. Why is that, why does v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha mean that you have to save your friend? Well, we know that there's a halacha which says, v'nishmartem et nafshotecha, that we're halachically obliged to take care of ourselves and our bodies. Hashem gave us our body as a gift to house our soul, and we're halachically obliged to take care of our body. Well, if we're supposed to take care of our own bodies, then if v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, you need to love your neighbor as yourself, then it follows logically that we would have to be halachically obliged to make sure that we guard our neighbor's body. So if that's the case, why do we even need the halacha of lo ta'amod al dam reyacha, that you can't let your neighbor come to harm? Because it should follow from the other halachas we just discussed. And I think the answer to why it's discussed in such great detail is we might not realize how far of an extent halacha requires us to go to actually spend our own money, literally treat other people's bodies and other people's life and health as our own, where we really literally would have to spend our own money the same way we would if we needed to heal ourselves, if we needed to save ourselves from something. We're halakhically obliged to spend the money on other people. Now, the question of how far does that go, and I'm not going to go into, there's obviously a lot of different avenues to explore, but one area where this is discussed, this becomes very, very relevant for practical halakha, and is discussed extensively in the Gemara, are the halachas called, the halachic body called harchakat nizikin, which literally means distancing from harm, or from causing harm. And the Gemara in Baba Basra extensively discusses what restrictions and requirements you need to have on your own basically business operations on your property in order to make sure that what you do on your own property doesn't harm your neighbor. I want to discuss these in a little bit of detail. First of all, one thing that is very interesting is when I talk to people who've learned Bava Basra and learned all of these laws from Chakat Nezikin, I ask them if they've ever learned any environmental halachas, and they say no. But as we look through and we start to read the halacha, you'll notice that it's actually a series of health codes and zoning regulations. So in fact, even though modern zoning regulations in America came into being in the early 20th century, and the very first regulations really in the early 19th century, about 2,500 years ago, there was a series of complex zoning regulations that were set out, and they have been discussed in great detail in the Jewish code of law that governed how farmers and people who operated industry in the Jewish villages had to operate to make sure that they were not causing serious harm to come to their neighbors. So let's look at source 5, the Mishnah in Masachet Bava Basra, Parak Bet. We'll look at Mishnah Chet, which is the first one. And it says, Marchikin Goren Kavua min ha'ir, Chamishim Ama, Lo Ya'aseh Adam Goren Kavua betoch shelo, Ela in Kain, Yesh lo Chamishim Ama, Lekol Ruach, Umarchikin Minitiotav Shel Chaveiro, Uminiaro Kidei Shelo Yazik. Okay, what does that mean? It means you need to distance a fixed threshing floor more than 50 cubits from the town, and a cubit is approximately 75 feet. And if you want to have one on your property, you have to leave a similar distance on all ends of your property. Why? Because otherwise it will cause a yazik, a nezik, a harm. Okay, so first of all, I actually have to explain what is a threshing, anyone know what a threshing floor is? Okay, a threshing floor is what you use to winnow wheat, which probably didn't help. But basically, you separate the wheat from the chaff. Okay, so basically, the flour you buy on the floor comes from the wheat stalk, and the way it gets from the wheat stalk to the flour is first they have to separate out this very, very, very thin skin that coats the wheat. And the way they do it, now they have more sophisticated methods, but they had the less sophisticated method was you stomp all over the wheat, and then you lift it up with big forks and you throw it up in the air on a good windy day, and the wind takes all of the chaff, which is a fine particulate, if you wanted to use a modern terminology, and it blows the chaff off of the wheat, so now you don't have little pieces of chaff stuck, like when you have a little popcorn kernel and that little coating from the outside gets stuck in your throat, that's what the chaff would feel like if you left it in your wheat. So it's basically, it was a fine particulate, and the Gemara and the Mishnah, and then the Gemara in later discussions, say this is, they didn't call it a fine particulate, but they said it was a fine dust, and it would coat the vegetables. And so you had to be careful to distance it from your neighbor's vegetables, because if you coat vegetables, they can't breathe and they die. And then there's actually some later sources which say, and in addition, it's bad for people because when they breathe it in, it makes them cough. I mean, they didn't discuss asthma and all the modern things we talk about nowadays, but there was a recognition this was something that could harm people and property. And as a result, the halacha required to be moved outside of the town. Okay, and let's see the next halacha. The same source is Marchikin et ha-nevelot ve'et ha-kvarot ve'et ha-borski min ha'ir hamishim ama. So you had to distance, these are more things you had to distance, a tannery, a graveyard, and carcasses had to be distanced from the city. Why? Because, and it goes on in great detail, because they smell, and it's not pleasant, and it can really bother people and injure their health. So why all of these things? Carcasses honestly likely referred to the local garbage dump, because back then a garbage dump didn't hold much more than bones because they didn't throw out all the stuff we throw out nowadays. They reused most of what they had. A cemetery for obvious health reasons, and tanneries really, really smell bad. I mean, no one here lives anywhere near a tannery anymore, but back then, actually the Gemara says one of the few things a woman can ask her In the Gemara, it says a woman can get a get from her husband if he's a tanner, even if she knew that when she got married, because there's just something you can't realize beforehand how bad it's going to smell. So this was something that really affected people, and it had to be moved outside of town. These two look at, re'echa. These are really looking, they say, if you look, go back to the ahavta le'recha kamocha, this is re'echa, meaning your neighbors, all of your neighbors. It was really dealing with the whole town that you lived in. There are also laws that deal more specifically with what you do on your property and how it affects your next door neighbor. So the next halacha really talks about marchikin eta marsak min hayerek. I'll leave you to read the rest of them, but I wanted to talk about that specifically. This is talking about flax. Flax is a fiber that was used extensively and could still be used today to make a lot of different things. But the only way that you can use flax is to soak it first. It's very stiff when you first use it, harvest it, and you need to soak it to make it softer. The problem is that when you soak flax, you get cyanide, which is not very healthy for the plants right next door. And so the halacha said, if you want to make a pit to soak flax, which was one of the industrial activities people engaged in, you have to move it a certain distance away from your neighbor's vegetable garden so that the cyanide doesn't leach out of through the walls of the pit and kill your neighbor's vegetables. So we see here that there's more in this Mishnah, and there's more we'll talk about later, but basically, there are a lot of domestic things that you, both industrial and domestic things, that were regulated on a regular, in a very detailed discussions, literally down to how many cubic feet you had to have, that because of the precept that we're not allowed to cause harm to other people. In fact, there is also, if you look at source 6, is an interesting, again, corollary to a modern regulation. The Mishnah says that you can't put a series of things, actually looking at the middle of that, and it's olive refuse, manure, salt, and lime. Couldn't be placed on, if your neighbor had like a wall on the for the property line, you couldn't place those against the wall, but you were allowed to place them on the wall if you whitewashed the wall. Why? Whitewash is basically a coating of lime and it's a mixture of lime and some other things that protects the wall. It was used extensively. It's like the Tom Sawyer, he had to whitewash the fence. It's the same thing, and it was basically used, that was their original way of painting things to basically protect them in the outdoors. So why were they allowed to do that? Because the concern was causing harm, and whitewash, you were allowed to whitewash your neighbor's wall for them because that would protect the wall from the corrosive things you were putting in. And today, we have, we've had to find in modern environmental regulation, there has to be a balance between industry operating and the fact that it can cause harm. And one of the balances that's found in modern environmental regulation is something called best available technology. So in some of the modern environmental regulations, there's a requirement that if you build a new factory, you have to use best available technology to reduce the pollution that factory causes. So 2,000 years ago, the best available technology was whitewash. Today, there are much more sophisticated things, and a modern American environmental law requires it, and perhaps halacha might have something to say about that as well. I'm going to take questions at the end. Okay. There are also extensive regulations regarding incompatible uses of, there are things like putting something that causes a lot of smoke and smell underneath of somebody's store, and extensive discussions about what you're allowed to do in your property. Again, most of us don't have a threshing floor. Most of us don't have a laundry pit. Most of us don't soak flax. But we do things in our everyday life that ultimately affect our neighbor, and I want to talk about that as we move forward. One thing that was very interesting is, again, a corollary between Jewish law and American law. In Jewish law, if you, for example, you build your wall 3 feet into your neighbor's property, and your neighbor doesn't say anything for, Jewish law it's 3 years, in American law it's longer. After 3 years, your neighbor loses the right to protest, and now that's your property. If you decide to set up if you build a wall, a building that actually blocks your neighbor's access to light, and again, if you protest within 3 years, you're actually required to move that building, but after 3 years, you lose the right to do that. But the halacha says, and this is Rambam, I brought the Rambam for you in source 9. Halacha says that you are not, there are 4 things that you can't give up your right to protest against. Which means 3 years, 5 years, 35 years, but you can still protest against those things. And what are those 4 things? Those four things are basically four types of, they're basically pollution. There's smoke, smell, dust, and vibrations. And the Ramban discusses this extensively, and you'll see that in his Hilchot Shchinim, which is the laws of protecting your neighbor, he says the reason is because of health. Because these are four things that affect your health, and because there is a halacha, v'yahavta b'reacha kamocha, and there's a halacha, lo tamod adam reacha, you, as a Jewish person, are responsible for harm that you might be causing your neighbor. So if your neighbor, after 35 years, develops asthma, or develops some sort of respiratory condition, or develops headaches, or some sort of health problem that is a result of your business activity, they shouldn't even have to bring you to court. If they tell you that what you're doing is causing them a health problem, you should immediately stop what you're doing, because you should be protecting your neighbor. Now, you ask, well, how does that allow, how can you ever build an industry that, you know, that produces one of these things, because someone could always kick you out? So here's where there's a disagreement between the Rambam and some of the other sources. Rambam says you are allowed to sell your right to complain about these four things. So you can sell, somebody wants to say open up a bakery, can buy from his neighbors the right to complain about the smoke. So that means that's it, they've sold it, and they can't ever complain again. So he never has to move his bakery. Other commentaries say that you can't even sell your right to complain about these things. You're just gonna have to look at your bakery outside of town, or whatever it is that's producing these, like in a modern day cement quarry. And this is actually one of the famous cases you learn in law school. In law school, there's a case where there was a cement quarry that was operating in a town. And of course, the town was really small, so nobody cared. And then people moved in because there were good jobs. And then people built nice houses. And then they were upset because there was a cement quarry there. And the cement quarry is not very pleasant to live near. It causes one of these four types of pollution. Causes actually two or three of them. There's a lot of vibrations. It's dusty. And it's really unpleasant to live near. And there was a whole discussion in American laws, there's very, very early zoning regulations, about whether they were allowed to make the cement quarry move, because the cement quarry was actually there first, and they moved in later. And ultimately, the quarry did not have to move, but they actually had to pay everyone who lived there some sort of compensation for the fact that they were suffering. So many, 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 you know, hundreds of thousands of years earlier, it was the same discussion in Jewish law. And there's really a debate, and the debate's never really resolved one way or the other. There's no, you know, final halacha on this. Rambam says you can sell your rights to these, and other halachic authorities say you can't. And so that poses an interesting problem for us operating. If we, for example, have a work in business or work in industry, and we have an industry which is causing one of these types of pollution, and then the question is really, what does halacha say about what we have to do? The difference between how halacha dealt with these things in the Mishnah and the Gemara and how we might have to deal with these things today is that in the times of the Mishnah and the Gemara, there was a lot of what we call somewhere else. There was a lot of outside of town available. And so it was there was a relatively simple solution to basically most of halacha, when it's something is going to cause damage, just says, okay, go outside of the town. The problem is, there isn't really any more outside of town left. There is no somewhere else left. There are people living in all the somewhere else's. And so one of the things that we need to really start thinking about, and this is something that I've spent a lot of time thinking about with other people, is how would halacha deal today with where we would put these things? And I think that the halachas that we just learned, where the discussion between the Rambam and others about whether you're allowed to sell your right to complain and how far we have to go to protect health, is a really interesting part of that discussion, because we obviously, clearly, halacha thought industry was very important, otherwise it wouldn't have had all these discussions about how you protect your industry. Even though these sound like restrictions on industry, in fact, they're protections, because if you think about it, if v'yahavta l'reacha kamocha means that you can always complain and force an industry to move, then how could you ever have an industry? These halachos were, in fact, giving industry a parameter within which they could operate, so you could actually know what was going to happen. And so halacha clearly thought industry was important and it needed to be part of our lives, and tried to strike a balance, which was appropriate at that time, for how the industry would operate. And I think today would try to do the same thing. It's just that the somewhere else is occupied, essentially. I want to talk a little bit about resource management, which is very much a discussion, part of the discussion of environmental, you know, the somewhere else, just like there's no somewhere else, the ability to find resources is diminishing rapidly. And actually, this goes back even further. When Yehoshua entered Eretz Yisrael, he made 10 takanos. And this is actually in source 12. And of the 10 takanos, one of them was people who did not live in Tveria were not allowed to fish in the Kinneret with nets. Does anyone know why? Anyone think of why? Because they're taking... Right. They were allowed to fish with fishing rods, because you can't catch that much with a fishing rod, but they weren't allowed to fish with nets. Another reason, in addition to the fact that they would kill the local economy, is if you live somewhere, you are more likely to take care of it. So if it's your business, for example, to fish in the Kinneret, you're more likely to get together with your local fishermen and make some sort of rule. You can't catch the little babies, because then we won't have fish later. You can't, maybe you set up a season for fishing so that you're not overfishing it, because you guys all know that if you overfish it this year, next year you don't have anything to live on. But if you don't live there, you're coming from outside of the town, then you don't really have any incentive to keep the Kinneret fish population, alive and healthy. So this is a very, very early example of what is in fact a major problem today, which is nobody really lives on, you know, the big oceans, and I'll talk about this later, and in fact 90% of the large fish in the ocean are gone. There have been a lot of attempts by countries to make things work, but the fact is, when you could see it, but it's the Kinneret and it's in your backyard and you go there every day and you see what's happening, you're more likely to protect the resource. And so very early on, Yehoshua set this regulation down because he wanted to make sure that there was protection of this resource. In the same set of takanos, there was a prohibition against raising small cattle in Eretz Yisrael. Why? I've been getting a lot of good answers. Why small cattle? Why is small cattle a bad idea in Eretz Yisrael? What do cattle eat? Grass. What happens when you pull up all the grass somewhere? What happened in America in the 1930s? Dust bowl. Right, you pull up all the vegetation and there's nothing to hold the dust, the dirt down. Well, Israel's a semi-arid country, similar actually to the Midwest. And you pull up all the, it's not a very big piece of land, and so there's not like you can graze across all of America. But even in America, the Midwest is much larger, and it was overgrazed and it was over-farmed, and there was a dust bowl, and the same thing in Eretz Yisrael. And this is going back again, way before, you know, anyone in modern times realized this was a problem. They realized if you allowed small cattle to graze in Eretz Yisrael, they would rip up all the vegetation, and then there'd be nothing to hold the water and the topsoil down, and you would end up with a desert, essentially. So this is fascinating. I'll tell you that the Dust Bowl continues. It's just not in America, so most people don't realize it. But in sub-Saharan Africa, the desert is actually overtaking where people live at a rate so rapid that people literally have to move every 6 months because where they once had a place to live is now desert. And it is because they are forced to, they don't have a good understanding of their agricultural system, but also because the modern economy has forced them to live in a way that's not, quite frankly, sustainable. And they will overgraze or they will plant a lot of the same crop that gives them money very quickly. And it's very hard to explain, because they're making money right then, that even though they're making money right then, that means that in 10 years from now, they won't be able to. And there's a lot of groups that have started to teach sustainable agriculture in sub-Saharan Africa, because it is a very real and immediate problem for people to literally have to have a desert encroach on the ability for them to live, literally, not just earn a livelihood, but literally to live. And a lot of the famines, increasing famines that we're hearing about in sub-Saharan Africa, while due to other things as well, are also due to the fact that the desert is moving up more and more, and when there's a desert, you can't plant anything to live on. Rabbi Land, the need to have a sustainable ecosystem goes back to the recognition goes back to the Chumash. Rabbi Lamb, in one of his articles, points out, and this is source 13. I have to tell you, I read this pasuk many, many times and never really thought about it until Rabbi Lamb made this point. It's Hashem says to Bnei Israel, Lo argarshenu mifanecha b'shana achat. What is Hashem saying here of the context? He says, I'm not going to kick all of the people who live in Eretz Yisrael out. This is when Bnei Israel are in the Midbar. And he says to them, I'm not going to just kick all of the people who live in Eretz Israel out the minute you step foot over the border. I'm going to kick them slowly, slowly, and they'll be kicked out. Now, I knew this concept, and I thought the idea for many years until I really read it closely after I read what Ari Lam said was that Hashem wanted to show that it was Bnei Israel's, that he was helping Bnei Israel as they were progressing. But what in fact says, if you look at the actual language, it's because if I kick out all the people and there's nobody living in the land, then it's going to go to pot. You know, the wild animals will take over, the well-tended fields will be destroyed, the gardens will be destroyed, everything's going to be gone, and you'll have to start from scratch. So instead, I'll kick them out slowly, and you can take over what's already a functioning ecosystem, which has a farmland that you can live on, and places for you to survive, and you won't have to start from scratch, kicking out the wild animals, you know, rebuilding the fields. And I really never thought of that before, but it's Hashem, you know, telling Bnei Israel from a very early time, you really need to pay attention to what's going on in the land because it really affects you on a day-to-day basis. And I found that insight to be very, very interesting going back that, you know, to the Chumash. All of the different laws that we just discussed, they're all little pieces here and there, but the defining theme of all of these laws is going back to V'ahavta l'recha kamocha. What does that mean? It means that you need to, and I try to pick halachot that we can at least relate to in the modern world, because we can understand what a smell is, what a vibration is, what a particulate is, but the fact is these are not our modern problems, by and large. The byproducts that are being dealt with, the pollution, essentially, of all different types, is a modern problem, but it's not necessarily, I personally do not operate any industries. I personally don't have a tannery. I don't soak flax in a pit, and I don't really do so much laundry. At least not by hand. So I don't cause any of these specific things that the Mishnah is discussing, and I would venture that most of the people in this room don't either. But the fact is we all, in our everyday lives, do things that ultimately do cause pollution to be generated. And it is therefore incumbent on us to figure out how in our lives as Torah observant Jews, we should be understanding what our impact is in what we do, and then trying to work together as a community, individuals and as a community, to figure out what halacha would say about how we are supposed to regulate our activities today to make sure that we are keeping the same halachot that we described earlier in the modern context. In fact, the halachot that we just discussed extend far beyond the individual, and they also extend to God's creations, who are, in a sense, our neighbors on this planet. As we discussed previously, the ecosystem, Hashem recognized this when he was talking to the Bnei Israel in the Midbar, the ecosystem is where we live. So it's important for us as people to have an ecosystem that works or we have nowhere to live. And the Gemara in Masechet Shabbos says, there's something that I'm sure everyone's always heard. Rabbi Yehuda says in the name of Rav, everything Hashem created wasn't created in vain. And I didn't bring that source for you, but we've all heard the ant is very strong and the grasshopper is very industrious. It gives a whole list of all these plants and these animals and little bugs that we would think, why are they there? And it explains why they're useful. I would say except cockroaches. Those aren't mentioned. but the point is that Hashem created, the point of that Gemara is that Hashem created everything for a purpose. I want to just give you an example of what, you know, the ecosystem is a little bit hard to grasp, okay? But just to give you an understanding, 25% of every drug used in in Western medicine is derived from a rainforest ingredient. That means one out of every four drugs that's used in modern medicine is from the rainforest, okay? This is when we've only tested 1% of the seeds and plants in the rainforest. 80% of what you eat comes from the tropical rainforest. Sugar, coffee, vanilla, potatoes, rice, yams, lemons, most of the spices you use were originally found in the rainforest. Unfortunately, the rainforest is disappearing at a rate of about 50,000 species a year. And when you think about all of the benefits we have out of the rainforest in our modern society, and the fact that we've only tested 1%, we are losing potentially resources that Hashem created for us to use and to better ourselves that we'll never be able to find again. Because once they're gone, that's it. The duty to protect and guard against harm to our neighbors extends to other species because of the fact that we need them to survive and must form the basis for how we interact with our environment. This Shabbos was Shabbos Shira. On Shabbos Shira, we have a tradition to put out food for the birds. I don't know, my little kids always come home with a little milk carton that's, you know, got little holes cut in the sides so they can make their little feed the birds. And so why? Why do we feed the birds on Shabbos Shira? What do the birds have to do with Shabbos Shira? Anyone? What? So they ate the man. Hashem sent that this is what happened. Moshe told Bnei Israel that the man would not fall on Shabbos. And a bunch of people tried to create trouble, and they gathered up man, and they saved it, and they put it out on Shabbos morning so that Bnei Israel would think that Moshe wasn't telling the truth, something happened. And Hashem sent the birds to eat the man. So we thank the birds on Shabbos Shira for coming and saving Bnei Israel from yet another place, because really there were enough in the desert, we didn't need more. What does that have, why, you know, Shabbos Shira always comes right around Tu B'Shvat. Have I ever thought about why? Well, Tu B'Shvat is the new year for the trees. So I have another question. Why do we need a new year for the trees? Trees are important, trees are special, but what is the idea, and why do we have a new year for the trees in February? Normally, it would be snowing or something crazy, you know, cold. It's not when I think of trees growing and thriving. The fact is that the Shabbos Shira and the celebration for the birds and Tu B'Shvat are related. And how are they related? We're going to look at source 14. You all said it this morning when you woke up. Berachot HaShachar, the very first bracha we say every morning is, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech HaOlam Asher Natan L'Sichvi Bina L'Hachin Ben Yom L'Vein Laila. If you look in the Rav Hirsch Siddur, I know there is another Siddur that translates this a little differently, but a Sichvi is a rooster. This bracha is, thank you Hashem, the very first bracha we say in the morning is thank you Hashem for giving the rooster the ability to tell the difference, the insight, l'havchin bein yom u'bein laila, to tell the difference between day and night. Of all of the things I'm thanking Hashem for, that's the very first bracha? Thank you for the rooster? The answer is yes, because that's where the relationship of Shabbos Shira and Tu B'Shvat come in. Because Hashem is telling you the very, very first thing you need to recognize in the morning is thank you Hashem for creating the environment I live in that is makes resources available to me that I can use to better myself. Thank you Hashem for creating intelligent animals. Where would we be if we couldn't train animals to pull plows? Where would we be if we couldn't train, even in a modern context, we have seeing eye dogs. We have so many animals that serve functions, even in modern society, but that much more so in the agricultural society, that made our lives livable. And if Hashem had not created animals with the bina, with the ability to be a helpmate to humans, then we would not be able to better ourselves and improve our lot in the world. And so what is this tie-in? The birds, if we had not had the birds, the birds were not intelligent enough for Hashem to give them direction to go eat the man, we would have had a chet in the midbar. Tu B'Shvat, the celebration for the trees, is not just about the trees. It's a celebration of the beginning of the spring. And in fact, in Eretz Yisrael, right now, is literally when the sap starts to rise in the trees. And so we should take from Tu B'Shvat and the Shabbos Shira, and we should remember this every morning in the bracha that we say, that the reason why Hashem wants us to have a new year for the trees and to remember the animals every morning is because that's what we need in order to survive. It's for, in addition to Hashem creating everything in this world for it to have a purpose, the ultimate purpose we learn was on the Yom Shishi at the end, which was humans. And in order for humans to be able to survive, we need everything Hashem created for us. And we need to be constantly sensitive and reminded once a year, thank Hashem for the trees and for the animals and for everything else that's in the natural world that we, obviously, as Americans, especially living in, you know, the East Coast, don't really experience on a regular basis, but in fact find essential for what we do literally every single day of our lives. And so not just are we reminded once a year, Rosh Hashanah Le'ilanot, the Tu B'Shvat, we are reminded every single morning when we make the Berachot HaShachar that we need to be conscious of the natural world, and not just conscious of it, but thankful of it, above and beyond not being a slave, being Jewish. I mean, there are so really, if you look at the order of the brachot, to put this first really says something about the priority that was put on having an appreciation for the natural world. And part of the appreciation for the natural world is making sure that we don't destroy it. Nachum Rackover, deputy attorney general and advisor of Jewish law to the Israeli Ministry of Justice, wrote a book, Hibatim Rayonim Umishpatiim V'Mekorot HaYahadut. It's environmental quality, views, reflections, and laws in Jewish sources. And I didn't give you the source in the source sheets. But he says in his introduction to the book that it's incumbent on us to recall that in addition to the fact that there exists a separate injunction to protect nature and the environment, we actually live in the environment. The issue of environmental conservation is not an abstract discussion of, you know, the spotted owl we all remember. It's a discussion about the world you live in, the world you will give to your children and the future generations to inherit, and a world that really affects you every single day. Ultimately, our duty to protect the world starts when Hashem created the world and put man in it. Nachum Rackover points out that stewardship over the earth is not just for the animals. It's for the sake of the human beings. So what does this protection entail? I can't give a speech on environmental issues and not talk about Ba'at Tashlit, but you'll notice it's many, many, you know, minutes into my lecture, because really, Ba'at Tashlit is again about the Ahavta L'Recha Kamocha. The Pasuk in the Torah says you can't cut down fruit trees in a time of war. You can read it in the sources. A lot of the commentators say, why? Why can't we cut down a fruit tree in time of war? Well, the answer is because you get a benefit from a fruit tree. Fruit trees, why would you cut down a tree in the time of war anyway? There's two reasons. Number one, burn up the land so that the people who are living there can't use it, so you knock them, you destroy them. Number two, you're actually going to use it for something productive, you know, make a battering ram, build a siege wall, whatever it is. Well, fruit trees aren't very good for battering rams or siege walls, so the only thing you're doing when you're cutting down a fruit tree is the scorched earth policy. And halacha clearly prohibits. That is very clear in all the sources that talk about this pasuk. It's very clear the scorched earth policy is not a Jewish policy and it is halachically prohibited. Why? Because when you scorch the earth, you're scorching it for you too. You're not just scorching it for the people you're trying to kick out. And so, you're allowed to cut down trees to build a battering ram. You're not allowed to destroy the ecosystem, because when you destroy the ecosystem and then you inherit the land, it's not very useful because there's nothing there that lives. Rav Hirsch says that in his commentary on this pasuk, that the edict, and this is, I'm literally taking from the English translation, written, over 100 years ago, the edict against destroying fruit trees is an example of general wastefulness. The purposeless destruction of anything at all is forbidden, so that our text becomes the most comprehensive warning to humans, beings, not to misuse the position which Hashem has given them as masters of the world and its matter, by capricious, passionate, or merely thoughtless, wasteful destruction of anything on earth. The extent of Ba'at Tashlit, there's a lot of discussion about Tashlit, and I will not go into it now. But just to give you an example of the extent that halacha went to talk about what it means to be wasteful and to violate the prohibition against wasting resources Hashem has put on this world for other people, I'll give you two gemaras, and I provided these in the sources in 17 and 18, but I'm not going to read them inside, but you can at your leisure. In Gemara Shabbos, Rav Zutra says, a person who needlessly covers an oil lamp or needlessly uncovers a naphtha lamp violates Ba'at Tashlit. Why? Because if you do either of these things, you cause the oil to burn more quickly. And if you cause the oil to burn more quickly, you're wasting a resource. And that's Ba'at Tashlit. The Gemara later in Gemara Shabbos, Rav Chisda says, ask the question, why are we allowed to eat wheat bread? Which is the flour that, unless you can't, most people, when you eat flour, that's wheat flour. Why are we allowed to eat wheat bread? Why shouldn't we be forced to eat barley bread? Okay? Why? And some of the commentaries say, why? Because barley, the grain, takes less water to grow. So if we're eating wheat bread, we are wasting water. And it says in the Gemara, it's because of a concern of Ba'al Tashlit. It should be considered by Ba'al Tashlit to eat a bread that's made from a grain that takes more water to produce. So here's what the interesting answer. The answer is, but as we discussed in the very beginning of this lecture, we also halacha v'nishmartem nafshotecham, that you have to take care of your bodies. And the Gemara says, wheat bread is healthier for you than barley bread, so you're allowed to eat wheat bread. But it doesn't say it's not baal tashchit. It just says we have to worry about v'nishmartem nafshotecham, and here it takes precedence. And what I find fascinating about both of these is, this is not destruction. This is just using a resource in a way that is not the optimal way to use that resource. And the Gemara clearly discusses the possibility that both of these cases are actually a violation of the biblical prohibition against wasting. To understand why the prohibition against wasting directly relates to our duty to protect our fellow man in the earth, we must understand what wasting means. Wasting is removing a resource that Hashem put on this earth to benefit man from the world. In a world of increasingly finite resources, when you remove a resource from this world and you don't use it appropriately, you are preventing anybody from deriving benefit from the resource that Hashem created for us to enjoy. Ultimately, taking the ability to use a resource away from society is an act of selfishness. It's a statement that you are going to do what you are going to do, and you don't care about other people. A violation of Yahavta L'Recha Kamocha. If we cannot care about others when it comes to simple actions, such as reducing our waste and paying attention to our footprint on this earth, how can we truly expect ourselves to fulfill the biblical injunction to be willing to put our actual possessions in line to save the life of somebody else? To return to three words, V'yahavta l'recha kamocha. The lessons from the Torah and from the modern understanding of environmental issues dictate that in order to properly protect our neighbors, we each have to learn about the consequences of our actions to the environment we live in, and we must really research and ask our Rebbeim what halacha would say that we need to do to avoid environmental degradation. Ultimately, environmental ethos comes down to this. Does the rest of the world have a place in your cheshbon, in your decision-making process that you make every single day with all the actions you do? The biblical injunction against lo ta'amod al dam re'acha, the commandment v'yahavta l'recha kamocha, the prohibition against baal tashchit, the laws prohibiting damages to a neighbor's property, the requirement to guard and preserve nature, all of these are a reflection of the Jewish responsibility to pay attention to the world around us and how our actions affect that world and the people who live in it. Ultimately, it is our job to be the light unto the nations and to have our actions not serve, unfortunately, in some cases as an example of wastefulness and a lack of care for the environment, but to have our actions serve as an example of how you can truly understand in the modern world what your actions are and how they will affect others. I am president of Kanfei Nesharim, an organization I started about 10 years ago now with a bunch of other people. Our byline is sustainable living inspired by Torah. Our goal is to educate the Jewish community about not just the halachot that you should consider in your everyday actions, but what it actually means to be an environmentally conscious Torah Jew. I encourage you all to take advantage of our resources. Our website is www.kanfeinesharim.org or torahenvironment.org, which is easier to spell. And I'm happy to talk to anybody about it further. We are actually using this year, we have, as Tubi Shabbat, we are using this as an opportunity to roll out a year of Jewish environmental learning. And we will be rolling out resources on 18 different topics related to halacha, the environment. We will have podcasts, webcasts, resources, and we're inviting communities across actually the world, because we have branches in all over the world, to take advantage of these resources and use them in your schools and shuls. And I encourage you, we have Divrei Torah on every Parsha. We really have an extensive set of resources for every Yom Tov, for every Parsha, for everything that you do in your Jewish life. On our website, we have Divrei Torah, resources, ideas, thoughts, and suggestions. And I really encourage you to take this and make this your year of Jewish environmental learning with us, so that you can make sure that you understand, in order to know how to properly fulfill the halacha of Yahavta L'Recha Kamocha, you need to understand what impacts your action have. And we encourage you to understand what your impacts are, and then as Torah thinking observant Jews, to put the same thought into your impact on the environment as you do into kashrut and sniut and learning Torah and davening and all of the other things that you do so carefully in your everyday life. Thank you. I think it's...